Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and I am so happy to be here with my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilbourne.
And hello, everyone. I hope it's a nice day where you are.
It is. You know, it's fall now. And but that's okay.
You know what? You know what? The trees are turning overnight.
I know.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah. Finally.
I drive down the street. Yeah, I drive down the street and there's a new color.
Oh, that's great. It. Well, we're going for a drive tomorrow, so maybe we'll see a whole bunch of colors.
Yeah. Yeah, we might.
All right. Well, okay. Who is our guest today, Mom?
Oh, today is Liza Nash Taylor, and the book is In All Good Faith. And it's a very interesting story. And Liza was a 2018 Hawthornden International Fellow and received her MFA from Vermont College of Fine Arts. In 2016, she was a winner of San Miguel Writers Conference, I'm not pronouncing things right, Fiction Prize. Her work has appeared in Microchondria 2, Gargoyle Magazine, and Deep South, amongst others. She is a native Virginian, and she lives in Keswick with her husband and dogs. And this book is very interesting. So,
and welcome back to Writer's Voices, Liza.
Thank you. Thank you, Monica and Caroline, for having me back.
Now, we spoke to you, of course, after you published your first historical novel, which was Etiquette for Runaways. And that really wasn't that long ago, was it?
No, they were just a year apart. I'm one of the only novelists I know to have two books published during the pandemic.
And that's something that to be proud of, and especially as those, they're your first two novels, too.
Yeah, it's right. Been a process, people ask me sometimes, what was it like to publish your book during the pandemic? And I say, I don't know any other way to do it. So, yeah, we just roll along, you know.
Yeah. Now, Etiquette for Runaways, the heroine was Mae Marshall, although she had a couple of different names, perhaps, during these books. And I remember the story of how you were inspired to write that first book, because it had to do with where you were living, and I think there was a broken bone involved.
Well, yes. I was taking my first class in learning to write novels, and I about 6 weeks in, I was texting and walking. Just don't do that. And I fell and broke my ankle, so I was stuck at home, couldn't drive. I was sitting on the porch in September, and trying to come up with where I would set this novel I was supposed to write. And I thought, well, I'm going to set it right here, where I'm setting in Keswick, Virginia, in this old house, this old farmhouse. And then that went on to also be the setting for In All Good Faith.
And you still live there, right?
I do. I've lived here for 25 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when did you start writing Etiquette for Runaways?
I was very late. I was a late blooming writer, as late blooming as anybody could be. When my daughter went to high school, when I was in my early 50s, I decided to get an English degree, and so I started taking literature courses, and that morphed into looking to get a degree in English, and then that changed into me taking my first writing class, and I did an about face and decided I really wanted to write a novel and I needed to catch up. So I applied to an MFA program. So that was in 2016. I started the MFA program and started working with an agent, and the first novel, Etiquette for Runaways, became my master's thesis. And while I was working with an agent, I also had to be creating new work for my master's program, so I started the second book. And I wasn't sure that the first one would ever be published, so the second one had to stand alone. So I started out from the beginning with the concept that this was the same. There were some of the same characters, but the book had to stand on its own.
So the first book, the time period that you're writing about was Prohibition, and then into maybe the very beginnings of the Depression.
Yes, it goes more in Jazz Age Paris. It ends in 1926.
Okay.
So In All Good Faith picks up Mae Marshall Craig's story 6 years later.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So so you're going from the Golden Age, the Jazz Age, the, you know, everybody partying to nobody partying.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yes. Yes, it was, that was a challenge because I was fascinated by the Depression and the things I found out about how the Depression played out in the area where I live in Keswick, Virginia, which is central Virginia near Charlottesville. And I didn't want to write a book that was a real downer. I mean, there are a lot of depressing books about the Depression out there, and I didn't want mine to be that, but I did want to hit on the hardships of that era. And we think when we read about that era and think about the 1930s in rural communities, we kind of think that, oh, well, the farmers had it. They were set. They had cows and chickens and crops, and they got through it fine, but they really didn't because there were foreclosures on farms. The crop prices were very low. In Virginia here, there were a whole series of weather events and insect, you know, hordes of locusts and tree blight and things like that that I thought were really interesting. And I thought, well, living in the country really didn't mean that you had it easy when people in the city were suffering. So I was trying to portray someone in a city going through the Depression and someone in the country on a farm going through it.
Now, Caroline, you were born in this time period.
Yeah, 1935.
And was the Depression, you know, so by the time you are probably old enough to have memories that we were going into World War II and coming out of the Depression,
mm-hmm.
but was that still, mm-hmm. was the Depression something that was still talked about a lot? Were you aware of as a child?
Well, I don't know. My dad was a lawyer. And my mother's family were farmers.
But, so just like the characters in All Good Faith.
yeah, right. But, you know, I never heard a lot of complaining. I really didn't. From my mother's side of the family, they did the best they could. And, you know, they...
But there were a lot of farmers that were having to mortgage their property or losing the farms completely. I mean, I remember seeing a basket of mortgages that Grandma had that she said that your father's father had loaned money to all these farmers during the Depression and then just forgave the mortgages.
Yeah, he probably did. Oh, that's something I wanted to ask you too, Liza, about, you know, when that family had to sell their property, did people really step up and just keep bidding lower and lower and lower like that? Did that happen?
Yes, that actually started in the Midwest with dairy farmers who were going out of business. And in some cases, they would threaten a judge, but they found it, I think, more effective to go quietly, not saying a word about it, but show up at these auctions and just sort of take over. I think that there might have been a few instances of actual violence, but it was more about intimidation and kind of doing the right thing. And when you talk about forgiving mortgages, I'm sure that these bankers and people, you know, these are people who'd had relationships for lifetimes and for generations with banks and farms, and all of a sudden farmers found they couldn't pay the mortgage, or their crops weren't selling. So I'm sure it was difficult for the bankers to foreclose on these people. And in the early 30s, there weren't any federal programs in place to protect property and protect farmers from these sorts of things happening. But that did change once Roosevelt was elected.
You know, I heard an interesting story a couple weeks ago. I went to visit Cedar Rock, which is a state park here in Iowa, and there's a home that was designed and built and completely furnished by Frank Lloyd Wright on this property, and it's open to the public. And the story was that the couple that built it, whose names I can't remember now, or whom he built it for, were from that area, which it's northeast Iowa, but they were living in Des Moines, and he had a patent on some oil process or something and become very wealthy. But some of his relatives back in this rural county had written to him during the Depression and said, could you buy our farm and lease it back to us, because otherwise we'll lose it. And apparently he did that for about 5,000 acres.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's a big farm.
Yeah, well, a variety of different farmers. It wasn't just one farmer. He did it for quite a number of farmers in that area, so that they could continue farming that land.
Oh, bless his heart.
Yeah. So, interesting. So, very interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit about Dorrit and your other character, your other main character in this book. I understand she sort of appeared out of nowhere.
She did. It's funny because I started out trying to sort of draft what was going to happen in this novel. Knew I wanted to continue Mae Marshall's story, and I had an idea of the trajectory of her life, of where she would be in the early 30s. And as I was doing research and trying to just sort of educate myself about the Depression and how it affected the area where I live, I kept kind of stumbling over events in history that I thought were really interesting, but they took me away from Mae's story. And I began to have sort of, I've heard of other authors having this happen. It's never happened to me. This character sort of blossomed in my head, and she would not go away. And I kept thinking, oh, I'll put you in a short story or something. And I kept coming across things in my research that made sense. And once I sort of started listening to this character and gave her a name, which is a combination of two of Charles Dickens' characters from Little Dorrit and from Oliver Twist. So I named her and she sort of sprang to life. And all of a sudden, all of this research I had done clicked into place. And I thought, yes, her story can run parallel to Mae's story, and at some point they're going to meet, and their stories, they'll cross paths, their stories will intersect, and their lives will affect each other. And once that sort of clicked into place, so much of the research I'd done, but I've been trying to sort of shoehorn it in, wasn't really fitting with Mae's story, and then it all sort of fell into place, and I hadn't ever written a dual narrative before, but it ended up being I would write one chunk of Mae's story and then divide it up in one chunk of Dorrit's story, and then working carefully to align the dates so that the date was always moving forward. And they might experience something, the same event, but they had to be in different perspectives. And then it got really tricky once you put those two points of view in the same room, and you're writing a chapter where they're both standing in the kitchen, and you have the author has to decide, whose head am I in now? Whose perspective is this particular scene going to be told in? And so that's an interesting exercise as a writer to write that dual narrative, and I really enjoyed it.
You did a good job. Thank you.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Liza Nash Taylor, author of In All Good Faith. Yeah, that I wanted to talk a little bit more about that process of writing from two different perspectives. So did you wrote both of them chronologically going back and forth between the two?
Well, at some points I would, you know, it's funny, for me, my writing process is I'll sit down and some days I feel like I can write dialogue. I can write a scene in dialogue. And some days I feel like that's not coming to me and I'll just do research. So what I was finding was I would sort of play out one character's story and then come to, then looking back on it, you can sort of see a point where a paragraph where it's a good place to break, where you've either got like a cliffhanger to end the chapter on, or it's just a natural place for that particular chapter to end, and then you switch back into the other character. But it takes a lot of juggling, actually, to work out these two. And some people do 8 different characters' perspectives. I haven't even attempted that. It's quite ambitious. Oh.
It is quite ambitious, and it can also be difficult to follow as a reader.
Yes. I agree, but some authors are very good at it.
That is true. That is true. So would you go to 3? Would you go to 4?
that's a really good question. I'm working on another novel now, and it has one main character, but I keep feeling like I'm waiting for something to tap me on the shoulder, either a slight. Another scene, another location in the novel, or another point of view, and which is what we call, you know, each character who's speaking or who's a main character, we call that point of view. And so it hasn't come to me yet. I try to stay open to these sort of inspirations that seemingly come out of nowhere. I think really our subconscious is working all the time on this when we're not thinking about it. So I'm going to see what happens with this third one, but I don't really see myself doing 4 or 6 or 8 characters in one book.
What year was that Veterans March to Washington? What
1932.
Year did that take place?
It was in, started in the summer of 1932. And it's interesting. I had read this book. He's 93. And I asked him if he had any recollection of the Bonus March. I think he would have been about 6. And he said he doesn't have any memory. And he grew up in Virginia, in Portsmouth, Virginia. He said he doesn't have any memory of anyone talking about it or it being in the news.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about this, because it's something that I had never heard about.
I had neither.
You know, was this something that you knew about from a history class somewhere, or just something you stumbled upon? And how big a deal was it at the time? And what was it for people who haven't heard of it?
Well, it was very big in the news at the time. In 1932, and we're talking about the very depths of the Depression. And of course, the Depression that started in 1929 after the stock market crash, at that time people had no idea how long this was going to go on. And by 1932, they'd been in it for 3 solid years. And in Oregon, a group of 8 World War I veterans got together, and they decided that they were going to cross the country on foot, or hitchhiking, or riding the rails to get to Washington to talk to Herbert Hoover and to ask for the early payment of their war bonuses. And these were payments that were contractually to be paid to all the veterans in 1945 with interest.
And this was veterans of World War I? Or...
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes.
And which ended when? What year did that end?
1918.
1918. So why so long?
Well, because if they had paid them all a bonus after the war, of course, after the treasuries depleted from war, it would have bankrupted the treasury.
Okay.
So they put them off. They said, we'll give you interest, but we're not going to pay you anything until 1945.
Okay.
So these 8 veterans, they called themselves the Bonus Expeditionary Force, and they set out from Oregon. And as they made their way across the country, they gathered a tremendous amount of support. They were sort of these underdogs. And the press started following them and noticing them. And along the way, people were joining in. And by July, this is in May of 1932. They got to D.C. There were 14,000 of them. They were camping all over Washington, D.C., along the riversides. Mm-hmm. In partially demolished office buildings, and the government didn't know what to do with them. The army was trying to find enough cots and sanitation supplies and food for them, and charities came, and the Salvation Army had a big tent. A lot of the men brought their families. So by July, there were 20,000 veterans and their families camping out around Washington. If you can imagine, it was unsanitary. It was hot.
Oh,
there
my
mosquitoes,
gosh.
There was illness. And in a huge publicity fail, Herbert Hoover refused to meet with the veterans. So I saw a photograph of it, and so I started looking more deeply at this event. I was never taught about this in United States history in school, and I think that's because it's something of a black mark on our history. And what mm-hmm. happened was that a bill was proposed, and it did not pass for the early payment of these bonuses, and a lot of the veterans just stayed on. They had nowhere to go. They'd lost their farms, or they had given up their jobs. And so they continued through the summer, and at the end of July, Hoover sent Douglas MacArthur and Dwight Eisenhower in with tanks and tear gas to clear these camps out, and they did it overnight. And these people who had arrived with all of their belongings on their backs had like 20 minutes to clear out. So it was not a great part of our history. But I thought it was fascinating, and I'd never heard about it. So I imagined what would happen if you took a teenage girl with anxiety issues and plunked her down in the middle of this whole event.
Wow. And that was Dorrit.
That's right. That's right.
Now,
and so she camps out with her father. She goes to the bonus march with her father, and they called these encampments Hoovervilles, and that stuck through the rest of the Depression. All of these encampments in cities were called Hoovervilles, and Hoover was not well thought of at that time.
Now, another big part of Dorrit's backstory is being Christian Science.
Yes.
A practitioner of Christian Science. I'm curious as to what led you to have her family be part of that religion.
Well, it's funny because when I first knew that Dorrit was going to be in the story, I knew somehow that she was from Boston, and I think I came across maybe the Mother Church of Christian in my research. And I've always been sort of interested in the whole philosophy of Christian Science, and for listeners who don't know, it is not the same as Scientology. It was started in 1879 by a woman called Mary Baker Eddy after she claimed to have experienced a divine healing. And so in the 1930s, most practitioners of Christian Science, and their mother church is in Boston, they didn't generally see doctors or go to hospitals, and they would pray for healing. And so when Dorrit experiences symptoms of anxiety, she asks her mother, am I normal? What's wrong with me? And her mother says, pray about it. So I just found the beliefs of Christian Science to be so interesting that I wanted to make her mother something of a religious zealot in this faith. And of course, now I actually visited the church, the Mother Church in Boston, and I had a tour, and I then was able to ask questions to some of the scholars at the Mary Baker Eddy Library. They were very helpful. Now I think the religion has more modern views about things like childbirth and hospitalization and vaccines and things. But in the 1930s, it was fairly restrictive.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It is.
Wow.
I can only imagine what it was like in Washington D.C. with those. How many people were there again? Did they estimate?
20,000.
Oh my gosh.
And then they were dispersed with nowhere to go, no money.
Yeah.
Nothing.
That's right. They put them in trucks and drove them over the D.C. line and left them in Virginia or Maryland.
Oh wow.
Yeah, no wonder we didn't. No wonder it wasn't in the books, in the history books. It is a black mark.
It is.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Liza Nash Taylor, author of In All Good Faith. Liza, would you care to read from the book for us?
I'd love to. Thank you, Monica. And in fact, the part I chose to read is set on July 28, 1932, and leading up to that. And it's from Dorrit's perspective and set in Washington, D.C. And one of the encampments that I was talking about was called Anacostia Flats. It was along the Anacostia River. So that's where she is in this scene. She is 17. She's there with her father, Roy. Scene. There also in the scene is her friend from camp, Nellie, and Nellie's husband, Sam, and also a veteran that Dorrit has met earlier in the summer called Charlie. And there are a couple of journal entries that are in the first person that are part of this. At noon, the beleaguered and bedraggled veterans, freshly insulted by the formalized request to withdraw, stood in sullen clumps, some holding dog-eared placards. Over the weeks, they had settled into groups by state, gathering under hand-painted signs. Roy lifted Dorrit to stand on a low stone wall beside Nellie, who jostled her fussing baby against her chest. Sam stood on the sidewalk below, with his little son straddling his shoulders. Dorrit watched her father wind his way through the crowd, patting men on the back, nodding at others, stopping to stand with Charlie and a group from New England near the front. The police commissioner, in his now familiar khaki jodhpurs and well-polished black boots, began speaking through a megaphone, once again urging marchers to go home. When he paused, Charlie yelled back, "We ain't leaving, Glassford. We'll stay till 45. A murmur of uneasiness passed through the crowd. Dorrit stood on tiptoe, watching, balancing with a hand on Sam's shoulder. With a red-faced roar echoed by the veterans, Charlie hurled a brick toward the line of police. She watched her father's face contort as he hefted a stone, as if he absorbed the combined anger and hopelessness of the assembled men. As he pitched it forward, his uniform cap fell behind him. The veteran shouted, fists raised as a whistle shrilled. A black-uniformed line of police surged to meet them, billy clubs raised. Dorrit called out, "Pop, no!" But her voice was lost in the fracas. All around her, people pressed close, and suddenly she was 9 years old again, lost in the parade crowd, her voice overwhelmed by horns and cheering. Her throat closed. Her heart pounded. Nellie grasped her arm as she watched policemen surround her father and Charlie, pulling them away. July 25th. I was so scared today it made me dizzy. Here is what happened after the rally. Nellie and Sam walked me back to camp. On the way, I found a policeman and asked him what would happen to Pop. He said I should check the jails. Then I tried to telephone the police station, but they said Pop might not be processed yet, whatever that means. We have a little food left, but not much. Without a veteran's card, I can't get rations, and Pop has all of our money. Oh, I wish we had gone home after the vote. A little while ago, Sam and Nellie came back to our shack. Sam said they're going home to Georgia. He gets a train ticket from the VA. and the Red Cross is buying tickets for some of the women and children. Nellie started to cry and told me to stay with them until they leave, though there's hardly room in their shack for her family. I said no, that I need to be where Pop could find me. I asked another policeman about Pop, and he said I needed to ask the military police, and I haven't seen any. Tomorrow I might go to the Red Cross tent to ask if they can help me find him. I do not like staying here by myself. July 28th. As long as I have a light on, I feel safe. Tonight is my fourth night alone. I need to write fast because the lantern is low on kerosene and the batteries in the flashlight are nearly gone. I've blocked off the door with a piece of wire and a board and placed my shears with Pop's heaviest wrench where I can reach them. My satchel is my pillow. Lumpy as it is, I'm grateful for it on account of I don't believe I have ever been so tired in my whole life. I'm hungry, and the mosquitoes are terrible. The police came around today, telling everyone to clear out, and they weren't so nice about it this time. I asked them about Pop, but they said they couldn't help me. I thought he would be back by now. Most of the folks around our shack left this afternoon, but I need to wait till I find out where Pop is. I hope he is not hurt. The Salvation Army has taken their tent away. They will not be recruiting Dorrit Sykes. Yesterday, I went to knock on the doors of some nice houses close by, but nobody would buy one of my beaded change purses. I believe that the people here in Washington are tired of us. One kind lady gave me a sandwich and a glass of milk. That got me through the day. She reminded me of Mrs. Frazier, and that made me homesick. Tomorrow, I will go and find General MacArthur myself and ask him about Pop. The lamp is sputtering, so I'd best turn it off. The rattle of metal woke Dorrit. Alarm constricted her throat. Raising herself to her elbow, she reached for the flashlight and her father's wrench, calling in a thin voice, "Pop, that you?" Sitting up, she switched on the light, looking around frantically, as if a back door might magically appear. "Pop?" This time a pleading whisper. A strong smell of smoke hung in the air, along with another harsh chemical odor. Clutching her nightgown, Dorrit peered out from the door, and her hand dropped to her side. As far as she could see, Anacostia Flats was burning. In the distance, bands of soldiers resembled insects in their gas masks, their images wavering in the firelight, crisscrossed by the blaring white of searchlight beams. Wielding torches, they worked their way systematically down the lines of shacks and tents. Cardboard structures went up like fireworks. As Dorrit watched, a tent canvas flapped upward like flaming wings, then fluttered into bits of red ash. Army tanks crawled over the landscape, appearing and reappearing through columns of smoke. How long until the soldiers and tanks got to the shack? Despite the heat, she trembled. The air burned her skin. The noise outside grew louder, nearer, as she struggled into a dress, unaware of the time or how long she'd slept. Holding a handkerchief over her mouth and nose, she took a final glance around the shack. Taking up her satchel and her father's tools, she began walking carefully, looking out for live cinders and nails, away from the bands of soldiers, away from the drifting, noxious brown smoke. Thank you.
That was Liza Nash Taylor reading from In All Good Faith. Now, going back to May's story, and she was, you know, in Paris when we left her last at the Etiquette for Runaways, and she ends up coming back to Virginia. She faces some challenges, too, having to do with, obviously, with the depression and with the problems for farmers, but also kind of sexism.
Yes.
And, you know, she's just trying to save the family farm and help her family get through this, but What are some of the obstacles she runs up against?
Well, in May's story, she has fewer actual, you know, physical challenges. It's more a theme of perseverance and resilience. And in the 1930s, men were expected to be the providers while the women stayed home. And that, of course, all changed during wartime. But basically, an unmarried woman was labeled a spinster and generally disregarded by society. A lot of American institutions, like the railroads and the postal service, during the Depression, they laid off all of their female employees to make those jobs available for men who had families to care for. So I think that for men, the struggles of that era were tied to their self-esteem as breadwinners. And for women, they were trying to juggle, you know, keeping the home going on less and less and less and then nothing. Some men left their families in search of work and never returned. Kristen Hanna writes about that eloquently in her recent novel about the Depression called The Four Winds. So women at this time, they learned to adapt and make do and make things stretch, and they entered the workforce where they could find jobs like picking crops, and they proved that they could work as hard as men. So May's conflicted by the pushback that she gets in attempting to revamp her family's business to adapt to the hard times. And she struggles with being a working mother and with her position in her marriage when her husband has to close his office and take a job out of town. So she decides to act on her own intuition, her business intuition, without her husband's consent. And in 1932, that was a big deal. And a woman couldn't get a bank loan, even a married woman, without her husband's signature. So we hear the statistics and we see the devastation in the photographs from that era. But it, you know, these mothers are the ones that really resonate with me the most. And so she was dealing with being a wife, being a mother, trying to start a business, trying to keep, you know, her family together during this challenging time.
I'm really curious about the business that she's starting, which is a candy company. Is it patterned, or was there a specific candy company you had in mind when you were writing about this?
Oh, that's a really good question. No one's asked me that. I love candy. And so I started,
who doesn't?
I bought a few books about the history of candy, and it was so interesting because it was in the Depression when they first started being able to manufacture, I think they called them like combination candy bars, where instead of just like a Hershey bar of solid chocolate, they started doing things like Clark bars and Baby Ruth, where they could do, you know, a caramel center or a nougat center and a chocolate outside. And they started marketing them to for their nutritional value. There was one that was called Chicken Dinner. And it didn't taste like a chicken dinner, but it was supposed to be as nutritious as a chicken dinner. Still not very appetizing. And the original label had a roast chicken on it, and then they changed that. And then they marketed that candy bar by retrofitting a whole bunch of pickup trucks to look like giant chickens, and they would drive around and sell these candy bars like an ice cream man would sell ice cream. So so when I read that, I thought, well, what if she comes up with an idea for a candy bar that will get a person who's down on their luck for a nickel through a good part of the day, because 5 cents would buy a candy bar that was, you know, calorically dense, and so and it was portable. You didn't need to cook it. It had a shelf life. So that sort of, I just got sort of sucked into this whole candy marketing that was going on. Like Necco wafers were very, very popular. They'd actually been around since the 1880s, and then Admiral Byrd took 2 tons of Necco wafers, and I think it was 1928, on his expedition to the North Pole, because they never go bad. And Necco in these years had this big truck that looked like a giant roll of Necco wafers. And I just thought all these things were interesting and kind of fun, and so I decided that writing about the candy and the history of candy would be an interesting direction for her to take the family market and the orchard that's failing.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
So did you have to, like, sample a lot of different candies to get the descriptions right?
Yes. And I started actually in the first book, I have the character Blue, who runs the Keswick Market. He's making taffy. And I remember with my grandmother making pull taffy, which was basically burnt sugar caramel, and you would pour it out and put butter on your hands and then pull it the way they do, the way machines do, like saltwater taffy, until it gets lighter and then it hardens. So it sort of started with that. But yeah, I made that, and of course I read about candy and ate a lot of candy, and I was really happy recently to see that Necco wafers have come back on the market after being they weren't produced for about 5 years, but now you can go buy them again.
Oh, wow. I used to love them. I love those things, especially the black ones.
Yeah, well, you can get them again.
Wow.
Yeah.
I forget which character was it that made her realize that, you know, you could put your candy in a machine and people would buy it out of a vending machine. Yeah.
Yes. That's Dorrit's father, Roy, who has worked. Necco stands for New England Confectionery Company, and they were based in Boston, or right outside of Boston. So that was one of those little bits of research that sort of clicked, and I thought, oh, well, Dorrit's father could have worked for them. So he was an itinerant mechanic, and he has worked on candy machines. So he knows about them. And, at this time, they were just sort of coming up with developing vending machines and all of the factory, like how to make a Reese cup, what kind of machinery would make something like that. It's a really interesting history.
That is interesting. I didn't realize vending machines were around that long ago.
Yeah.
Wow. But they weren't refrigerated ones, right?
They weren't. I think I believe that at that time, like they would have Coca-Cola coolers that might say Coca-Cola on the side, but they actually had to put ice into them. They might have been insulated, but they didn't have any way to actually cool them electrically.
Right.
Oh, yeah. She had to buy some ice, didn't she, to get that
That's
candy?
Right. Yes. Yeah. You have a good memory.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, I can't imagine, having all that beautiful candy in those beautiful boxes and having it all melting. Oh, that was so, I thought, oh my gosh. Yeah, that was something.
Wow. Now, Liza, when we originally had scheduled our interview, you were in Paris, I believe.
That's right.
Your apartment didn't have good enough Wi-Fi to be able to do it from there.
No, very, very spotty Wi-Fi.
How long were you in Paris? Okay. And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was my first big trip since, quarantine. So I was there for 2 weeks, and I stayed at an apartment where I've stayed, I think this was my fifth time staying, and I've gotten to know the owner, and I actually got to meet her for the first time, and she's 78, and she came into the apartment holding a helmet under her arm, and I said, Beatrice, are you on a motorcycle? And she said, yeah.
No.
Anyway, it's in a neighborhood that I love, the 8th arrondissement, and it's her Paris home, and she lives in Provence otherwise, but I went with my daughter and my sister-in-law. We've been multiple times before, and we travel well together, and I used that apartment as a setting in Etiquette for Runaways, and it's where May first does heavy drugs for the first time. And so I took my landlady in Paris a copy of the book. In English, her English is perfect, and I gave it to her with some trepidation. I said, Beatrice, I hope you won't be offended by what's going on in your apartment in my book. So I haven't heard if she's read it yet or not. But while I was there, I was also doing research on the novel I'm working on now, which is set in 1952 in Paris, and it has to do with the life of the designer Jacques Fats, who was in his day as big as Christian Dior and Cristobal Balenciaga, but he died at the age of 42 from leukemia, and he was, you know, we don't remember him as much as Christian Dior, obviously. But he was very big in his day. So it's that's sort of the true event that this next novel is built around.
And is there any connection back to Keswick Farm in Virginia?
I'm playing with that. I'm really tempted to that's sort of the easy out, but I'm really tempted to make it something to make it stand on its own and not relate back to this.
Now, May was a costume designer, and her and Dorrit is a seamstress. And was May's mother a costume designer, too?
Yes, May's grandfather in New Orleans had a costume company where he specialized in making costumes for all of the parades and everything around Mardi Gras. And that actually is a legit business in New Orleans. So the May's mother has grown up, you know, with the beads and the sequins and designing these costumes.
So obviously fashion and costuming is something that you have a strong interest in. You want to tell us a little bit about your background?
Well, yes, I learned to knit first when I was six. My grandfather was an invalid, and he had a full-time nurse, and she would just knit. She could look at my Barbie doll and knit a form-fitting mini dress just without any kind of a pattern, and she taught me to knit, and then both of my grandmothers sewed. One taught me to sew on the machine, and one would knit lace, and so I was always interested. I was that sort of nerdy girl in high school who was, like, making patchwork quilts. So I always loved design and color and art, and that ended up taking me to New York to the Fashion Institute of Technology for graduate school. And I lived in a rooming house, which was the Roberts House, which is actually a setting in Etiquette for Runaways. It was still going in 1981 when I was there. And for $75 a week, you got a room and two meals a day, and it was like a dormitory, no boys allowed upstairs. And so before I finished that year-long graduate program at FIT, I was hired by Ralph Lauren, and that was sort of my dream job. And it ended up being, I loved it. I learned so, so much, but we were not very well paid, and I got married during that time for the first time, and I was commuting, and it was just, it really was very, very demanding, and I ended up getting out of it. But I have kept coming back. I designed a line of cashmere baby accessories, and now I'm working on a children's book that involves little hand-knitted animals that I started making during COVID and quarantine. So it's still very much a part of my life, and I like I don't dress particularly fashionably, but I like to follow fashion.
Well, gosh.
And Liza, on your website, I see also that Charles Dickens is a strong influence on you. And,
yes,
of course, we know that from the name of your character being pulled from a couple of Dickens characters. But what is it about the work of Charles Dickens that has such a strong influence on you?
I think he excelled in the page turner. I think because most of his early novels were serialized, so he would always have to end on a cliffhanger. And from what I've read about his life, he didn't really know what the next chapter would be. He would turn in the pages to the magazine where it was going to be published in, you know, a chapter at a time, and then he had to come up with what the next action would be. He was like one of the original pantsers, which means riding by the seat of your pants. It's his characterization to me. You know, now we have the influence of television and visual cues when we, or even audible, even audiobooks, when we hear about characters or see characters, we can judge them for ourselves. But in Dickens' time, it was all about the description. And he, I thought, brought his characters so fully formed to life that you had no question about what they look like or how they sounded. And he was brilliant at he could have 12 or 15 characters in one book, but each one was so distinctive. And that, to me, is what really makes me want to keep going back and learning from him.
So are you also a pantser?
Yeah, pretty much, I think, although I'm kind of running into a wall right now with that strategy. I didn't really start out knowing the basis of the story, but what happened with In All Good Faith, with Dorrit sort of jumping into the action, I like to leave that door open, that I might come across something in my research that's so compelling or interesting to me that there's room for the story to grow and form around that. And that's happened with both of the novels I've published. So I think it's just sort of my method. And sometimes, well, with both of my books, I didn't really know how they were going to end until I was well into the story. And that's, there's something a little frightening about that, but it's also giving you room for your characters to sort of surprise you and grow on their own. And then at some point I might think it was going to end that way, but that character would never really do that, you know, once you get to know them. So I guess I am pretty much of a pantser.
Now, Liza, you also deal a little bit peripherally, but still in a real way with racism during this time period. How do you do that?
Well, that it's more of an issue in Etiquette for Runaways in the 1920s. And it was something that I kept coming across in my research, especially in researching the life of Josephine Baker, who is the inspiration of a character who's an entertainer named Janie in the first book. And I realized that I could either sort of gloss over it or I could cite some incidences that might surprise us today reading that these things really happened, that a black celebrity might not be allowed to take the elevator to their room in a grand hotel, and that this was pretty common practice. So I made sure that the way I handled it was I didn't want it to be sort of, you know, over the top. And every instance I put in the book, I wanted to be sure that it was based on something that happened in history to Josephine Baker or to someone else, and that I could actually qualify that, yes, this kind of treatment actually occurred, and here's where, and here's who was involved, and so forth. So, but that's not what the book is about. I just felt like it's part of that time, and I didn't feel like I could ignore it.
Right, right. Now, in All Good Faith, what, this grand old mansion, Southern mansion, gets converted, not Keswick Farm, but a nearby home, gets converted into a boarding house for former vagrants, or people who might be vagrant if they didn't have a place like this. Were there homes in your area there that happened to, and were the neighbors upset about it, or how, you know, what's the historical background of that?
Well, I think during this time, a lot of people rented out their spare rooms in cities and in the country. I know there's a farm up the road from me that at some point, and I don't know when this happened, but the owners of the farm moved into one of their cottages and turned the main house, the farmhouse, which is not an estate, it's not a big estate, it's a pretty simple, but a big clapboard farmhouse, and they turned it into a rooming house, and it's still a rooming house. So I guess they could keep the cook on because she would then be producing meals for the tenants who were paying, you know, weekly rent or whatever. But I think that this was really fairly common to rent out a room if you had a spare room during the Depression.
Right. So we know you're working on your third novel now, and when I look at your literary history, you've also done a lot of short stories. Are you still writing short stories as well?
You know, that's an interesting question. No, I'm not. When I first started writing fiction, I found it easier to start with short form, where you can, you know, a character will have an arc, the action might happen in one afternoon or 3 days or something, and it was just sort of a more compact package, and you could, you know, it had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so that was sort of how I learned to write, you know, to draft and write was in the short form in a story. And then I had a couple of those published and decided that I really preferred to draw a story out farther and to take a character over a couple of years, or, you know, to introduce other characters and take that one character to different settings. So really the novel form, once I went through the master's program and really learned the nuts and bolts of how to put those things together, I realized that the novel form was really suited my temperament much more, and that it was a big project, and you would work on it in chunks and then fit the parts together, and that's sort of what I've stuck with.
All right. Well, we're glad you did, so we can enjoy these novels. Liza, our time's up, and I want to thank you for joining us again today.
Thank you, Monica and Caroline, for having me again. It's been great to talk to you.
And Caroline, do you have some closing words?
Yeah, I do. Actually, they were they're from the book. I like to do that. I can. This is something that Dorrit had a pretty rough life, pretty rough time, and it's her thought was time. In time, wounds of the body and of the heart do heal. We go forward even when we don't know which direction we're heading.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you all next week on Writers' Voices.